Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Patty Nagai is back with us. She's a retired UW Extension horticulture educator. And today we'll talk with her about fall tasks in the garden. We can talk cleanup. We can talk about bulb planting. We can talk about all kinds of things with her. And I hope you'll join in with your questions and comments as we move along. You can join in by calling us at 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or you can send us an email to ideas@wpr.org. And certainly we'd love to hear from you. And Patty Nagai, welcome back.
Well, thanks for having me, Larry. It's weird not being in the studio, but I'm so happy to be online and talking to everybody around the state, and you especially.
Well, I'll tell you what, the last time you were on last January, and we certainly didn't think this year would turn out the way it did.
No. Did anyone really think this was going to be the crazy year that it's been?
You know, I don't think any of our garden plants got COVID, but it did have an impact on gardening. I think we saw a lot more gardeners this year.
It was a huge change in perspective on so many different fronts, but gardening definitely took a positive hit from this pandemic. So many people have taken up gardening that have not in the past. Plus, there were people who really delved into making their backyards, you know, the best environment they could have for this isolation, quarantine, stick to yourself, be a home hermit kind of thing that happened this year. So lots of people really got into it in a big way. It's interesting because I think that there are a lot of challenges that come from new gardeners and even existing gardeners trying to do more really fast. But one of the biggest pluses of it is our green industry, not just here in Wisconsin, but across the country, really boomed from all of this. It was a much-needed positive impact on our garden centers, nurseries, plant growers of all kinds.
Yeah. I imagine you tend to get lots of questions. It's sort of like a doctor who's not in the office and wants to know. What kinds of questions do you get, especially from the new gardeners?
Well, it's interesting. They are really all across the board. This year, I fielded a lot of questions about growing vegetables. I think people really took this seriously about learning how to grow your own food. So I answered a lot of questions this year about growing tomatoes in small spaces, in containers, how to incorporate herbs and vegetables into a flower garden, for example, you know, whether or not, how they can best use their space. And for people who've not gardened before, you know, how do you physically start a garden? Or is it better to try and build raised beds and do container gardening for everything? I also have been getting a lot of questions from more experienced gardeners about really interesting little disease and insect issues in some of their more established plantings. It really has been all over the place as far as questions go.
I don't know if you're looking at your computer screen right now. We got an email in a photo of Lucia's in Ashland, her acorn squash, which looked bumpy.
Really bumpy.
They're wondering what could have caused this. They didn't get any normal ones, I guess.
Right. So when I first looked at it, I actually thought it was some kind of ornamental pumpkin, you know, because it has that wartiness to the skin that you sometimes see in the ornamental pumpkins and gourds. And it does kind of look gourdy as opposed to looking like an acorn squash, but the shape is definitely acorn squash. I guess I would ask her, you know, what did the plant look like? Did you see any signs of a virus on the plant? So sometimes viruses are very sneaky and people don't recognize the plant as having a disease because the plant continues to grow and produce fruit, even though there are things that don't look quite right.
Yeah, so that made them. Yeah, go ahead. I'm sorry.
You know, and this would be a question for Brian Huddleston, you know, to be definitive about it. But bumpiness is one of those symptoms of a cucurbit virus, a virus that affects plants in that Cucurbitaceae family. But the leaves may have been showing some symptoms, too, that she just didn't recognize as being a disease. You might see yellow spots. Sometimes we see weird stem growth or twisted leaves, twisted petioles. With the phytoplasms, you see that fasciation, that flattening of the stem and funky things like that. But I, you know, my guess, and it's just a guess without really having any kind of analytical tools to look at the fruit per se, it just looks like it might be a virus.
And still okay to eat if it's not rotting.
Well, I would cut it open and see what it looks like inside. And, if it is one of the cucurbit viruses, you know, one of those mosaics or something, it's certainly not going to affect a human. But it might affect the flavor. So if it doesn't taste good, if it tastes bad, don't eat it.
There you go. That's good advice.
That's my rule for many things.
Well, let's go to Bill in Hayward. Bill, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Good morning, Larry and guest. I appreciate your shows, and I have an oddball question for you.
I love oddball questions.
During the summer, we had an apple, and I cut the top of it off, and I've been trying to get it to root. I have it in a small bowl. I have about an inch and a half of water in it, and I change the water every week. I do not see any roots coming out of it, though.
And so you've got a pineapple. Run that by me once more.
I have the top of a pineapple that I cleaned the bottom of as best I could, and I have been trying to root it so it can grow a plant.
Oh,
I don't see any roots coming out, though.
Well, with pineapples, you know, the key is to get them to send out little side shoots, and sometimes they'll send out those little side shoots before you see any roots, because typically the side shoots show up pretty early on. But it could be that your pineapple top was treated with something. You know, it could be that I don't know, it might have been treated. It might not have the capacity to make roots and to grow. I've never had a whole lot of success with this kinds of little replanting vegetable top things. I mean, I have done it with carrots and other things in the past, but it's typically not the most productive way to reproduce a new plant. Have you seen any growth at all out of the leafy structure?
No, none at all.
Well, then I'm thinking that it's after that amount of time, it's probably not going to happen. And I'm not saying that you shouldn't continue to try, because I'm all about playing around with plants and trying to see what you can produce from them. It's kind of a fun thing to do. But
rooting hormone, do you think, would that work?
Well, you could try it, but at this point it's probably
too late.
You know, that would be something that you would have to do early on. You know, if you had treated it, if you had cleaned it up and then treated it with a rooting hormone, one of those IBA kind of products that you can buy at the nurseries, they're typically called things like Root Tone or Root Tone F with the fungicide in it to try and do it. But when you use those rooting hormones, instead of putting it in water, you actually plant it. You put the rooting hormone in it, and you actually put it in a nice, clean potting mix, something that you know that does not have any outside sort of infections to it. You don't want to use like garden soil that would be full of various types of fungal organisms or bacteria. So you want to use a nice clean potting mix and then just set it down in there and keep it damp. One of the other things that you can do when you're trying to root anything is that you need to preserve the moisture in the top part of the plant. And so One of the easiest ways to do that is to actually put the whole thing. So let's say you have a small pot full of clean potting mix, and you've put your cutting or your pineapple top or whatever onto the soil, and you've watered it once, and so it's nice and moist. Put the whole thing into a clear plastic bag, and you can seal it up, but then you punch holes in it so that you've got a little bit of air movement, but that you're preserving that humidity in there to make sure that the foliage doesn't wilt or lose too much moisture. It's a little bit different with pineapple because they have such a waxy, stiff structure on those leaves that you would think that they would never lose moisture, but they will. They will lose moisture, too. They will continue to lose moisture, and if they're not able to take up water, eventually they will lose their ability to do anything. So
there you go, Bill.
I would say start over.
Yeah, get rid of that one and get a new
one. Try again.
You must obviously like pineapple, so that isn't too hard of a task we're asking.
I think. And I know that there are lots of people who have grown pineapple in their houses, are able to get a pineapple to form on the top part. But in production, usually the pineapple is the top part, the flower structure, the flowering, that inflorescence is what makes the pineapple fruit. But then reproduction happens from the base of the plant, where you have little shoots coming off the base of the plant. So when they harvest the pineapple, they remove the whole mother plant, and then they replant the little side shoots, the little baby plants that appear down at the bottom.
Thanks again, Bill. Appreciate it. Let's go to Barbara in Milwaukee. Barbara, hi.
Oh, I've learned so much from Patty Nagai. I want to thank her. And I know she gives a great, you're welcome, thank you. And I know you give a great spiel, just like you did the previous caller, on the topic of transitioning and acclimating plants, whether it's in spring, taking plants outdoors, or now in fall, bringing things indoors.
Right, right. It's been very important.
Is there a good online resource or some other resource that I can direct people to? I can definitely give them the basics of what I've learned listening to you, but is there something within the Learning Store or the Master Gardener site that covers that topic that you could refer people to?
That's a really good question, and I'm trying to think. We did a couple of things on hibiscus care, but I want to say that was done in the old InfoSource system, so I'm not sure if any of that got moved over into like a fact sheet or anything along those lines. I think it's a great idea for a fact sheet, and I could, if it's not out there, I could certainly write it up and send it in to Brian Huddleston for peer review and to get into the system because it's good. I just can't think if there's one out there already. You do know how to access the
Learning
garden fact sheets, right? Because actually those are accessed through the horticulture the Hort team website, that hort.wisc.edu site. And they can also be accessed at the PDDC site, the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic for UW-Madison, Brian Huddleston's website. All of the fact sheets can be accessed there. But they're both of those sites are easily attained through Google, too. So if you have a specific topic and you put in Wisconsin in the topic, so you say, like, Wisconsin hibiscus care, and see what pops up and see if it's coming from one of those EDU sites. You don't want to just grab hold of anything that is not university related. But that's a great idea for a fact sheet. I think it's really worthwhile because there are some things that people, and that is one of the questions that I've been answering a lot this week is, okay, when do I need to bring in my citrus? When do I need to bring in my hibiscus? And what do I need to do? Can I treat them for insects? All of these things that you need to think about before you actually bring it in the house. And then there are additional care things that you need to consider once you have it in the house, because all of these plants are going to have to readapt, acclimate to this new interior environment. And there are, in some cases, some really drastic things that happen, and then people think their plant is dead. You know, it might drop all of its leaves, or it might turn totally yellow, or they think it's gone. But it's really not. It's just acclimating to its new environment.
Yeah, making new leaves, different kind of right. leaves than what they had right. from the outside. That's right.
Right,
Barbara,
exactly.
Thank you so much. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too, 800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@WPR.org. Jill Nadeau, our producer today, our on-air producer, Jane Rotunda, Tyler Ditter, our engineer. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Patty Nagai, retired UW Extension horticulture educator. Always great to have her stop by and talk with us. And lots of questions, both email and phone. So we'll go back to the phones and to Bill in La Crosse next. Bill, hello. Thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Thank you for taking my call, Larry. This spring, I planted the... an asparagus bed. I planted the roots, just a small one in my backyard garden. And after I kept the bunnies out with a fence, I got some fairly nice frond growth for the second half of the summer. And they're looking nice and green now. What I'm wondering is, what do I do as far as going into fall and winter to protect those plants, but not smothering them or whatever?
Sure. What do you think, Patty?
I love it when people, you know, invest garden space in some of these perennial vegetables. I just think it's really cool. Asparagus is pretty easy to grow as long as it has full sun and well-drained soil. Once you get it established like that and you've got that nice green fern growth, just let that go until it starts to turn yellow. And it's really pretty. I find it very attractive in the garden. Yeah. So just... Yeah. Let it do its thing. When it starts to turn more of a brown and collapse, you can go out and cut it back. One of the biggest problems in asparagus beds is weed control. And so at this point, when you cut the plants back, if you have not put down any kind of mulch, it's a great thing to do in an asparagus bed is to actually put down a mulch. Some people prefer to use compost at this point for mulch because then they don't have the potential problems with a wood-based kind of a mulch. You know, they can put the compost down. It needs to be nice, clean compost that, of course, is weed seed-free. And you can put it down as 3 to 4 inches thick, no problem. The asparagus shoots will come back up through that so easily in the spring, and it'll give you a good start to spring without any weeds coming up through there. You don't really need to do winter protection on asparagus. They are incredibly hardy. They're really good. But that weed control issue is a problem for a lot of people. So I would suggest mulching to make sure. And then before you do that, of course, if you do have any weeds in there, especially if they're perennial weeds, I would say go ahead and pull those out and get it cleaned up. If you want to protect it as far as having seeds fall into your garden, which is an issue in my yard because I have a lot of trees that make seeds, I actually cover my raised beds when I get out there and get them cleaned up in time with a floating row cover, not to protect them from winter, just to keep the trash and the seeds from and the squirrels from burying walnuts in there. So a floating row cover works really well for that, too.
All right. There you go, Bill. Thank you so much for calling. On to Ann in Manitowoc County. Hi, Ann.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I had the late blight on my tomatoes, and I have it every year, but this year was the worst case of it. But I also had the best crop of tomatoes that I've ever had. So I know I have to discard all the debris and the mulch. And next year I plan to spread them out a bit and use some spray. And I'm wondering if there's something I can do now to prepare the soil or something to do extra in the spring before I even do the planting. And also wondering if the baking soda sprays are effective or if I should just bite the bullet and use a commercial product.
Great questions. One of my questions back to you, though, is that did you really have it diagnosed as late blight? Because late blight is a very severe disease that blows in. It's not in the soil. That's the one that actually kills the tomato plants. So if you had late blight, chances are you wouldn't have gotten any fruit off of the plants. I'm thinking that more than likely what you had was a combination of septoria, leaf spot, and early blight, one or the other or sometimes both, because those are soil-borne organisms. And one of the ways that we avoid that is to rotate our crops so that we're not planting tomatoes, eggplant, peppers, you know, because they're in the same family and they're all susceptible to those diseases, not planting them in the same area every year and rotating them around. That gets to be really difficult to do in a small vegetable garden in a home situation. And so then we start looking at other things. Removing the debris is super important for any of those diseases, especially if it really was late blight, because you don't want the late blight to overwinter in that plant tissue. So you take all the if it's late blight, you have to take it and put it in a garbage bag and actually either throw it away or let it sit in the garbage bag until everything's completely decomposed and dead. But with septoria and leaf blight, you also want to get all of that out of the garden. In the next year, if you can plant your tomatoes in a different spot, that's great. If you can give your plants a little bit more space for aeration and better sun and not so much overcrowding, that's great too. If you can mulch your plants so that you don't get soil splashing back up onto those lower leaves, that is super helpful. And then as far as sprays, the baking soda is not that effective on those types of diseases. There are some copper sprays that work, but copper is fairly toxic, so yeah, you have to use that with caution. It should never be used around water because it will kill fish. And it can be dangerous for people, too. So even though it's an organic spray, and there are the organic fungicides that contain copper and sulfur, you need to be very careful when applying them because you don't want to get them on yourself. And then there are the regular sprays for controlling early blight and septoria that contain, most of them I think contain the product chlorothalonil. And they will be labeled for tomatoes, very important if you're going to use a pesticide, that it's labeled for the plant that you're going to apply it on as well as for the disease that you're trying to control. But those kind of sprays, even those, have to be applied like when you see the very first sign of any kind of spotting on those lower leaves. But they do work. They do work, and they can be used safely. And as long as you're following the instructions and applying them correctly, you can certainly eat the fruit. There's no problem with that. And they do work. So you have a lot of options.
Yeah. Thanks, Ann. Appreciate it. Rick in Galesville. On to you now. Hi, Rick.
Well, good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I've got a five-year-long question. I planted some Concord grapes for our zone 5 years ago. And so far, I've got one bunch of grapes on them. I get lots of sprouts, lots of leaves. They do get a little brown once in a while. Give them a shot of 7, they're right back. Where's my fruit?
Well, there are a lot of things that can go wrong with Concord grapes. You know, sometimes it is the weather works against you, and the flowers don't actually produce a viable flower. Sometimes you don't get good pollination, so that's an issue. And then if you've gotten fruit and it's just disappearing, you know, you can blame that on the squirrels and the chipmunks because they'll eat it even before it's completely ripe. So they will. But it sounds like more that you're not getting you're not even, are you seeing the flowers?
Not a flower.
You don't see any flowers at all? Is your vine planted in full sun?
Yes.
And what's the soil like?
With compost.
So it's a really rich soil.
I wonder if soil is so rich that not getting good flower production. So it could be that you have a nutrient imbalance. it's probably too late in the season to do this because we're already going into fall and plants are doing their send everything down to the roots. But next spring, when you first start getting good-sized foliage on that plant, it would be worth it to take a leaf sample and a soil sample and send it to the plant analysis lab up in Marshfield and get them to do a nutrient analysis for you. It costs maybe $20. It's not super expensive, but it would be very interesting because it could very well be that your nutrient balance is completely off. In addition to that, if you wanted to try and do something before you get the results back, I would look at fertilizing with something that promotes flowering as opposed to adding something that has a huge amount of nitrogen in it. Chances are your phosphorus and your nitrogen are probably way too high.
Out of whack.
But it's really hard to tell unless you have the soil test done, you know. So that's what I would do. And then the second thing I would do is to buy another plant and plant another one because sometimes plants are just not good. I hate to say that about any plant, but it wouldn't be bad to invest in another one and see if you get better results with a different one or maybe even a different variety. I know Concord might be your favorite, but there might be another one that does better in your environment.
Pam DeVore at the UW Learning Store had mentioned now it doesn't relate exactly to what Rick's talking about. It relates to grapes. They've got a fact sheet or bulletin on training systems for cold climate grapes.
Yeah, you know, they do have some really nice publications for grapes, and that the trellising ones, the ones that show the different training systems for grapes, are excellent because that's another thing that can affect flowering and fruiting. I'm so glad you said that, Larry, because, you know, if the grapes are not pruned appropriately to the point where you have those fruiting branches, maybe pruning could help your cause as well, proper pruning. So I would definitely look up the publication on proper pruning and training. So thank you, Pam, for mentioning that, because I wasn't even going down that road of pruning. But pruning is super important when it comes to grapes as well as other fruit crops.
I had a friend who was had that issue, and I said, get a copy of Growing Grapes in Wisconsin from Extension.
Mm-hmm.
And he did, and he pruned, and then he had all kinds of grapes.
I think that's a great idea, because if it has not been pruned correctly, that will definitely affect the flowering.
Yeah.
Good idea.
Yeah, there you go, Rick. Thank you very much for calling. And we had an email with a photo a listener sent in of some sprouting lemon seed and excited seeds. She's excited that they're finally growing, and they look pretty healthy.
They look very healthy, and they're all different heights. And they looks like some of them are still germinating, and some of them are probably a good 4, 5, 6 inches tall. Cool.
Yeah,
very cool.
Cool.
It's always fun to grow plants from seeds, but I just have to caution people to remember that when you grow a fruit from seed, it's not going to be exactly like the plant that you got it from. And people sometimes forget that. It's like when you plant an apple seed, you will definitely get an apple tree, but it may not look anything at all like the tree that fruit came from, nor will the fruit look the same, because seeds, of course, are products of sexual reproduction, and, you know, you always get some interesting genetic changes when you have babies.
Yeah. Yes, you do. And speaking of apple trees, Jade in Medford had emailed, they planted a young apple tree this spring and wondering what's the best way to help it survive the winter.
Where are they?
Medford.
Medford. Is that in the middle of the state?
Yeah, it's not too far north.
Okay. Apples are very hardy. Newly planted trees, you know, and I use this recommendation for pretty much anything that's newly planted, especially if it's planted later in the later part of the season, will always benefit from mulch. So there's the regular kind of mulch that we put down around trees, shrubs, perennials that helps keep moisture in the soil and keeps weed seeds from germinating and helps to regulate soil temperature so that you don't have those extreme fluctuations. That is a good plan for any plant that is newly planted. But the second type of mulch that I sometimes recommend for when people are concerned about whether or not a plant is going to make it through the winter is called a winter mulch. And a winter mulch doesn't get put down until after the soil has frozen. So in our case, sometimes that's not until December. Many times it's not until January. And if it happens in January, it works out great because then you can, if you have a Christmas tree, you can take all the branches off your Christmas tree and use that as a winter mulch, because the goal of a winter mulch is to cover the plant, the whole base of the plant, sometimes the entire plant if it's not very tall, because you want to create a mound that's like 10 or 12, 14 inches tall of something that's very easy to remove in the spring. You know, it's not going to be permanent. It's only going to be there in the winter. And the purpose of that mulch is not to keep the plant warm or to protect it from cold. The purpose is to keep the soil frozen and keep the temperature a little bit more constant. Cold is okay. These plants are hardy. They can handle the cold. But what they can't handle is that freeze-thaw, 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 and in many cases it causes plants to frost heave or push themselves up out of the soil. And once they do that, that's the death knell, because the roots will dry out and freeze and, you know, you're done for. It's really interesting to look at, you know, so many of our plants are completely hardy. They might even be hardy to zone 3, zone 2. But if you look at their root zone hardiness, their roots may not be hardy to that kind of temperature extreme. But we count on the ground freezing and being covered with snow, and that the soil is going to stay at kind of a constant temperature of, you know, maybe 28 to 32 degrees, which is really not that cold. So the roots survive. But, you know, looking at the winters that we've had recently, I've seen a lot of plants not make it through the winter, and it's not because they're not hardy. The top part of the plant is hardy, but the roots are not completely hardy because we've been experiencing these very weird temperature extremes.
There you go. And Medford, yeah. In Medford, I'm trying to think, it's south of Rice Lake. For sure, but still, so, you know, it's north.
Is it like zone 4, do you think?
I don't know if it is or not.
Yeah, but, you know, apples are hardy. It's a hardy plant.
Yeah, so it's a hardy plant.
It should be okay, but protecting the root system is what's important.
And sometimes, depending on the size of the tree, protecting from rabbits or anything else.
Oh, that's true too. So that's a different thing altogether. I love hardware cloth. Hardware cloth is my friend, because that's the wire mesh that's only like, you know, a quarter inch, maybe 3/8 inch. You know, it's real tight mesh, and it's real easy to work with. And I make cages around the things that I really don't want my bunnies to eat, like my nice little dwarf Japanese maples that apparently are good rabbit food.
Well, Shirley in Nakusa has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Shirley.
Hi. Yeah, the question I've got is that can I put bark, or you were talking about mulch, around my tomato plants and different ones out in the garden next spring? Would the bark or mulch break down enough?
You know, if you're using wood mulch, you can use wood mulch. You can use it around tomatoes. It's fine to use it, but you don't want to incorporate it into the soil. And so you don't want to leave it there year-round. And people who will use these types of wood mulch, you know, I know a lot of people who do chip drops, and they just get freshly ground trees, and they use it all over the place. As long as it's sitting on top of the soil, it's okay. But you don't want it to get incorporated into the soil. So you can either plant your tomatoes and then put the mulch down around them to make sure that it keeps the soil from splashing back up. And mulch is such a great thing for tomato plants because it helps to keep the moisture in the soil. It keeps those weed seeds from germinating. But at the end of the season, you need to rake that mulch back out of there because you don't You do not want it to be incorporated into the soil. And you don't want to plant your tomato. Right. You don't want to plant your tomatoes in the same place anyway. And so if you're going to be planting, maybe you're going to be planting lettuce or some other crop there in the spring, that mulch is going to be kind of in your way because you need to get to the soil surface. So the interesting thing about wood mulch like that, though, is that the lower level where it actually interfaces with the soil, that lower level will break down nicely, and it's a beautiful thing because it helps to replenish nutrients. It's great for the microorganisms, those good guys in the soil. You know, it's a beautiful thing, but you don't want to incorporate it into your soil at the end of the season in a vegetable garden.
Good luck, Shirley. Great. Thank you.
Thanks.
Dave in Hudson, your turn. Hi, Dave.
Good morning. Great show. Great, thank you. So my question had to do with asparagus, and in Germany it's called Spargel, and they have Spargel Suppe, and it's white asparagus.
Right.
Do you know how I could cultivate that?
Oh, my gosh, I would have to look that up again to see how that's done. But I believe that they I know that there are some places. See, this would be a great question for my German friends, Heidi and Carl, because they probably know exactly how it's done in Germany. I know that there are some places where they create an artificial cave where they just, it's like completely dark and like that. But I know that there is a way to do it in the ground using a covering, but it has to be something that you can easily remove at the end. So you could use a soil-based covering to make sure. If it gets any light at all, it will turn green. So to keep it pure white, it has to be completely dark. Probably the cleanest way to do it, I mean, you could do a covering where it's like compost or soil where you keep it covered and you just keep covering it as it grows until it gets to the right height to harvest it. But probably the easiest or the cleanest way would be to construct some sort of box that keeps it in the dark completely. It cannot get any light at all in order to maintain that white color. And it's really soft, you know, that because it doesn't get exposed to the light and it doesn't get the chlorophyll production. There are also some other things that don't happen in the cellular structure. So the asparagus tends to be incredibly soft and tender because it has never been exposed to light.
I'm wondering about the nutrient value.
Yeah, it's not as, it's, you know, anything that's white is not as nutritious as something that is green, or purple is even better. So I'm all for purple asparagus. It's perfect.
All right. There you go, Dave. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Patty Nagai, our guest today, retired UW Extension horticulture educator. I'm Larry Mueller. You are listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Great to have you with us for this edition of Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Patty Nagai, retired UW Extension horticulture educator. Great to have you along. And if you have a question, you can email us at ideas@wpr.org or phone at 800-642-1234. Dan in Hubertus up next with a question. Hi, Dan. Thanks for calling.
Hi. I would like to plant my dwarf butterfly bushes today, and I'm a little concerned because frost is coming. Should I plant them, and should I mulch them at the same time?
Yes, you definitely should mulch them. Not the winter mulch, though. It's way too early for that. Just the regular mulch, you know, 3 to 4 inches thick to protect the root system around the plant. And, of course, when you do that, mulch shouldn't touch the plant. For best survival, the soil is still warm, so this time of year is a great time to plant things. Butterfly bush can be a little tricky sometimes. It's a little sensitive, but what I found is more of the recent cultivars that have come out have been, they've been way hardier. I still do the same recommendations that I always have, though, with butterfly bush. Do not cut them back in the fall. Make sure that they maintain their full structure through winter, and then wait until late spring before you start to cut back on them and only remove what is truly dead. You, depending on what the winter is like and where you are and all of that, it may be It may be really late in the season before you start to see growth, but you don't want to cut them back too soon. And you definitely want to leave them standing over the winter. It really helps with survival. From now until the time the leaves completely drop on them, you need to make sure that you keep the soil really moist so that they don't dry out. You don't want to stress them more, because even though you're not seeing any changes on the upper part of the plant, and you certainly should not be seeing any growth, and you don't want to fertilize them at this point, you should be experiencing a lot of root growth, which is perfect. That is exactly what you want for fall-planted perennials, is root growth, because that's what's going to help them survive the winter. In this case, because butterfly bush is a little bit of a finicky winter survivor, I would say that coming back after the soil freezes and applying that winter mulch would be very helpful.
And thank you, Dan, for calling. And speaking of planting things, Trish in Belleville emailed wondering how late into the fall season could a new grass lawn be planted in southern Wisconsin?
Oh, you know, I think the recommendations for that still, there's a publication on that. I know there is, but I'm thinking that they changed that to a kind of an earlier date. So even though you're in southern Wisconsin, you might be right at the very end of the time to do a lawn establishment through seed. You could still do like a winter sowing, but that, you know, that's such a different beast altogether, because you apply the seed after the ground is frozen, and then you hope for the best when spring comes as far as whether or not the seed is still viable and germinates in a timely manner. Fall really is a great time to seed a lawn, and I would say that if you're using just a regular seed mixture and it's not some special million-dollar valuable seed, I would say go ahead and try it. And because going into winter with a bare soil is so much worse than, whatever it cost in time and seed to just give it a try. It's really important that the soil is loosened up prior to applying the seed. And if you can use a light top dressing of either compost or that cellulosic material or straw, make sure that you put down some kind of covering. And then it needs to be sprinkled lightly, watered every day. Because if it's Kentucky bluegrass, those seeds take a good 2 to 3 weeks to germinate under the best of conditions. You need to make sure that the soil stays really moist. But, you know, sometimes things just happen that way, and it's better to just go ahead and try it and do it and just recognize that you might have some bare spots and you're going to have to do it again in the spring. Establishing a lawn from seed is a process.
Yes, it is. I had to reestablish some part of my lawn where there was a big kids jumping unit in the back, but I did that in early, like around the 1st of September. I've got lots of good grass back there now, but it's a little iffy right now.
Yeah, that's kind of the ideal time, is that end of August into the middle of September, because we're before frost, we have nice warm soil, we usually have a fair amount of rain, so we've got a lot of things going for us for seed germination in the early part of the fall, but we're into serious fall now, where we could have freezing temperatures, you know, we could have frost, we could have snow. I'm not quite ready for that, but I suppose anything's possible in this year.
Anything is possible. Jay in Plum City, let's go to you. Hi, Jay. Thank you for calling.
Hi, guys. Thanks for the show. It's a good show.
Well, thanks.
My question pertains to protecting apple trees or fruit trees from the mice and voles, and you were mentioning hardware cloth is what you like,
right?
And I've used hardware cloth on smaller trees, and one of the issues I've had is the trees sway and they get gouged by the top of the hardware cloth, which is a little rough, and then I get bad damage. And the other issue has the plastic stuff, which they say you can wrap with plastic, but then you're supposed to remove in the spring.
Right.
And when I've done that, I get a lot of bad sun scald on my trees. Mm-hmm. It's like they're, and so I'm just wondering if you, what you do to resolve the gouging of the, you know, the hardware cloth into the young bark when the trees sway, and the other issue is the sun scald if, you know, you use latex paint or something.
Yeah, I think, you know, latex paint's not going to hurt anything. But again, when it comes to trees and establishing them and getting them used to the real-world environment, we want our trees to move. We want them to have air. We want them to be exposed to the sun. I mean, those are all things that are really important for the trunk, a good, solid trunk development. So we actually want that to happen. I still like hardware cloth. If the tree is unstable, you know, you could actually stake it, you know, using a three-pronged stake method where you still get a little bit of movement, but it keeps it from going too far. But if it's just swaying a little bit, like the normal sway that you would want a tree to have anyway, at the top of the hardware cloth, you could take a piece of rubber tubing and split it and then wrap it around the top of that hardware cloth so that it gives it a little rubber bumper at the top so that it, when it does hit the tree, it won't hurt it.
I've seen that done, and it works pretty well.
Yeah, it works really well. I mean, you can use those wraps, the ones that are coiled and they're kind of loose, where you can kind of embed them in the soil in the bottom. Those are nicer than the wrap, like the really hard wrap stuff, because the plastic coils, at least you can get some air movement in there, and you don't have to worry as much about, you know, moisture building up in there too much. But if you use those, they have to come off in the spring because they it's just not good to keep that type of plastic around the trunk. So
yeah, there you go, Jay. Thank you so much. Ann in Milwaukee, hello.
Hey. Hi, guys.
Hi.
Thanks for the show. It's a great show. I had a comment and a question, and my comment is for the gentleman who's trying to sprout a pineapple. I've had success with that, and what I do is I leave about a quarter of an inch of the core. I trim off, I guess you'd call it, the shoulders of the fruit.
Uh-huh.
But leave a quarter inch of the core, and then place it on top of like a jar, like a mason jar, so that mm-hmm. just that tip of that core is touching the water.
Oh.
You don't want the leaf part near the water. Mm-hmm. And I've always had really good luck with that. I've done it a few times.
How long did it take for the roots to develop when you did it that way?
To my recollection, it was just a couple weeks.
Okay. So, yeah, he still needs to start over.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's great, though. Thank you.
Was if I put down, like, I think it's called 2,4-D or any sort of broadleaf treatment, I have two young trees in my lawn. One's a eastern redbud, and one is a peach tree. And they're both planted new this year. No, I take it back. The redbud is the second year. But they're still young and they're still getting established. Is that going to damage them at all?
And you would be treating for, like, what, dandelions or something like that?
Yeah.
Broadleaf weeds. Broadleaf weed control, it's great that you're asking this question, and I wish more people would ask these kinds of questions before they just, you know, buy products and spray them because, you know, they're seeing these broadleaf weeds in the ground. There are so many different products out there that work in slightly different ways or in sometimes very big ways. So it's super important to read the label and follow the application instructions very carefully. So, for example, 2,4-D, yes, it's a broadleaf weed control product that's been around since World War II. And that's a contact product, meaning that the broadleaf weed has to be green and growing, and you hit the green leaf and it kills it from the top. But a lot of the products that are sold for weed control are not just a single product like 2,4-D. They usually contain three, sometimes four different broadleaf pesticides, broadleaf herbicides. And so they have things in them like dicamba Dicamba is a different type. It works a couple of different ways. It can be absorbed through the leaves, but it also goes into the soil and can be taken up by the roots. And that's why on the products that contain dicamba, it states very clearly that you cannot apply this product more than twice a year, because it will be taken up by the roots of woody plants, and you will definitely see what's termed growth regulator responses in the trees. If it's something small or new, it could kill them, you know, depending on how big it is and how well established they are. But it can cause twisting and leaf mutations, like all of these weird little strappiness and curls and cupping and twisted petioles and also, or small leaves or no leaves. I mean, it's really
not good.
Not good. So it's super important, whatever broadleaf control product you choose, that you follow the label instructions carefully. Now, with newly planted trees, chances are, if you have planted them correctly and you have mulched them correctly, you should not be applying the herbicide to the area that's directly in the root zone of those plants. So first and second year, you might be okay because the roots probably aren't underneath the grass yet anyway. But for older trees, it actually becomes a more serious problem,
for sure. Patty Nagai, our guest today, a retired UW Extension horticulture educator. Always nice to have her with us for Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mealer. Frosty temperatures have signaled fall cleanup time in the garden. Larry Mealer here. Thanks for joining us today for Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Patty Nagai back with us, retired UW Extension horticulture educator, talking with her about some of the things that occupy gardeners in the fall. And lots of callers online and lots of emails, Patty. So I think we'll go back to the phones here for a minute or two and talk with Miles in Madison. Hi, Miles.
Hi. I have a question about fall preparation or winter preparation for an in-ground garden.
Okay.
Right now I have things planted in rows and some of them are in mounds, and I think next year I'll have a different layout. My question is, should I till the entire, it's an 18 by 18 plot, should I till the entire plot and then do a cover crop, or is it too late to do that?
It's a little late to do a cover crop. And, you know, current recommendations are to not do any tilling, because tilling is so disruptive to the soil. You know, I grew up in the era of you till, and you till some more. You know, you till between the rows, and you till in the fall, and you till again in the spring until your soil is like beautiful, lush cotton or something. You know, you just can bury your hands in it so easily. But we know now that tilling the soil is really disruptive. It's very it's really hard on the soil itself, and it's very hard on the good microorganisms that we have in the soil. So if you can avoid tilling, it's really better for your soil structure, you know, over time. As far as the mounding system and everything, you can certainly rake all of that out and get it prepared. It might be a little bit late to do a cover crop, much like when we were talking earlier about sowing grass seed for the lawn. You could possibly get a little bit of growth, but depending on Mother Nature, maybe, maybe not. There are some cooler season crops that are often used as cover crops that you might get a little bit of growth on. I know buckwheat is one of the ones that's a really good one. Alfalfa you can use. You can even use annual ryegrass, which germinates really fast.
Yeah.
And in that case, you would want it to germinate and get to a certain point. And then instead of tilling, you would, you know, probably want to cover it with something to kill it off so that it doesn't set seed. That's one of the biggest issues with cover crops in an area where it's not managed, is that if you let it flower and go to seed, your cover crop then becomes your weed plant.
and you know, Pam DeVore sent a note on cover crops. They have the Learning Store has a fact sheet or bulletin titled "Cover Crops."
Yeah.
Cover crops for home gardens.
Oh, that would be perfect. Yeah, that would be
a great
place to start and see. And there may be something that you could get a little bit of growth out of before the winter. And that's, you know, a lot of times that's what you need from a cover crop because you're just trying to increase the organic matter in your soil. But you need to have a plan on how you're going to kill that cover crop so that it doesn't flower.
Yeah, there you go, Miles. And just go to the UW Learning Store, learningstore.uwex.edu, I think is maybe the address for it. But UW Learning Store will get you there for that bulletin.
And that's great. It's just so interesting how gardening practices have changed over the years and what science has shown us about gardening practices. And I think it's still evolving. I think there's still a lot of science that needs to be done. There are a lot of people who use really widely different gardening techniques in their vegetable gardens, and they have success. So I think that there are many times there's more than one way to do it.
Marcy in Lake Geneva, we'll give you a chance now. Hi, Marcy.
Good morning, and thank you for taking my call. Wonderful show. I would like to know her advice for hydrangeas. Last year, which I had done in previous years, I cut them way back in the fall, maybe 4 inches height. And then this year they didn't bloom at all, so my husband is concerned that I shouldn't have cut them. I should have just let them winter and then cut them in the springtime.
Do you know what type of hydrangea you have?
Or? You know, I have the Annabelle.
Yeah,
and
Annabelle.
There's another one, and I'm not at home, so I can't remember.
Okay, so Annabelles are smooth hydrangeas. That's hydrangea arborescens, and it typically can be cut back. It's not usually a problem. But I wait until spring to cut things like that back, and I don't cut them. I wouldn't cut it all the way back to the ground. If you have big leaf hydrangeas, the hydrangea macrophylla, I recommend that those stand all winter. Those are the ones that will die back. It depends entirely on what Mother Nature brings us over the winter, but they will and can and usually do in my area die all the way back to the ground. But I still leave them standing, and I cut them back in the spring after I see new growth coming from the base of the plant. Paniculatas, those are the ones that are typically big, but not all of them are big. Some of them are little, like Bobo, which is a little tiny one. Paniculatas, you let them stand over the winter, and then in the spring you can prune them back by a third or a half, and they will bloom beautifully. It's not a problem. There are some older varieties of hydrangeas that bloom on old wood, and if you prune those back, you won't get any blooms at all. But I find that most of the ones that we grow nowadays in Wisconsin, newer varieties that you may have bought in the last, 10 years or so, they should bloom on new wood. When they don't bloom, sometimes it's weather-related. Sometimes it's soil nutrition-related. They may not have the right balance of nutrients in order to make flower buds. Sometimes our spring is just too cold and too wet and too long in that state to initiate enough good new growth early on to give them time to bloom. So that can be a problem as well. And with a lot of plantings, I find that people, unfortunately, on the tags of most hydrangeas, the tag is written for a national audience, and it says you can plant them in shade. But in our world, here in Wisconsin, they really need full sun. They just need full sun. They just don't. They don't warm up fast enough in the spring. They don't get enough sunlight to initiate those flower blossoms. So it's generally a combination of things. But for most of them, pruning may not need to be done at all. Or you can prune back in the spring.
And speaking of that, someone, Carla, had emailed wondering when to cut back hostas and daylilies, and I don't cut those back until everything's dead. I don't know about...
Well, hostas and daylilies are two plants that you can cut back early, and it won't be... I have some hostas right now that look so hideous that I am going to cut them back this weekend because they just are ugly. But if they still look good, I would leave them standing. But over the winter, those two plants are going to collapse. They're going to collapse, and they're going to get all mushy, and they're going to look awful. And so there's not a whole lot of winter interest with daylilies and hostas. So when you're ready to fall clean up, you know, go ahead and go ahead and cut them back.
I like those leaves to be getting the sun as long as they can for the roots.
Yeah. Well, it's better. The longer you can leave a green plant green in the fall, the better it is for the plant, obviously, because it's still working. It's still making photosynthate. It's still storing things down in its roots. And so what you're doing is supporting a really good, healthy root system. So good job, Larry.
Okay. Adam in Appleton, your turn. Hi, Adam.
Hello, thanks for taking my call. My question is regarding Brussels sprouts. This is the first year I've tried Brussels sprouts. And I guess I'm just wondering, I planted them in early May, and the plants look healthy, and the Brussels sprouts themselves just seem very small, and I guess I'm wondering where we're supposed to be at right now, and how long will it take before I see good-sized Brussels sprouts?
Well, you know, there's a trick to Brussels sprouts that one of my local farmers taught me, because I've only grown them once, and I, like you, was kind of disappointed with the production. The plants looked great. It's a really long-season plant, so you did all the right things by planting it early, and it takes a long time for the plant to get up there in height and develop the little buds on the apices. So it's really great that you did that. But the trick is that sometime in midsummer, you should top the plant. Because, like all plants, Brussels sprouts have apical dominance, which means it's still putting all of its energy into getting taller and growing from that bud at the top. When you top the plant, it causes the hormones to shift, and it pushes the growth into those little apical buds, into those little buds, those axillary buds, not apical buds, the axillary buds, which are actually the Brussels sprouts. So did you top your plants?
Well, I cut the leaves off from the bottom up as I was going, and I read that, you know, that allows the energy to go to the bud, but I did not top it. It seems like it has kind of stopped growing from the top now at this point.
Well, no, because we're into really short days and cold nights, so it stopped. But, yeah, sometime around the middle of the summer, you actually have to remove that top growing point. When you get it to the height where you have, I don't know, probably 12, 18 buds on the sides, you know, where you have, it's a good height. I mean, those plants get, about 2 feet tall. When you get to that height, you know, 18 inches to 2 feet tall, you should cut the top bud off, the top growing point. And that shifts the hormones down into those axillary buds so that then the buds start to grow. Otherwise, all of the hormones are still going to the very top bud to keep growing taller. And so it makes sense. I mean, as soon as the farmer told me that, I was like, oh, that makes so much sense. But unless you grew Brussels sprouts, you probably wouldn't realize that you had to do that. So it's probably too late to do it now and see any response. And, of course, the buds that you have are edible. Around here, people are starting to harvest their Brussels sprouts. A lot of times they'll wait until the middle of October or even the later October to harvest them, because Brussels sprouts, like all of the plants in that Brassicaceae family, once it starts getting cold, the flavor improves dramatically.
Yeah.
Just really, really amazing. So we are supposed to have a little bit of a warm spell next week. So you could go out there and just go ahead and cut the top off and see if it makes a difference. And then I would say wait until the weather's consistently cold to harvest them and give them a little bit more time to get a little bit bigger, and then the flavor will be much improved
once the cold
weather sets in.
I'm so happy that daughter Emily likes Brussels sprouts, because I do too. And sometimes kids aren't crazy about them, but she likes them. So
I think they're delicious, but But I like all vegetables.
There you go. Ellen in Waupun. Hi, Ellen.
Hi. I'm sorry. My husband is mowing lawn in the background here. I have a question about tree wrap. I was hoping you'd get to it when you were talking about other forms of trunk protection. I've put the paper wrap around a couple of new trees last fall, and I've never taken it off. Is that a mistake?
Yes. And, you know, tree wrap, just like those plastic wraps and other things, they do serve a purpose initially. So when we're trying to protect the trunk during transport, when we have a newly planted tree, sometimes it's used over winter to protect from, you know, deer or rodents or things like that. But even the paper wraps, they don't breathe enough. They create a very moist environment underneath, between the wrap and the trunk. You can get some disease problems. You can get insects under there. It's just not a good idea. And in some cases, people put those wraps on so tightly that they actually inhibit the growth of the trunk, because, of course, the trunk is going to grow laterally, and you need to allow it a chance to do that. And if you have a tight wrap on there, it actually can inhibit it over time. But any of those types of things are only supposed to used on a temporary basis, because we want the tree to establish itself in the environment. Just like staking, we want the tree to move. The tree needs to move back and forth in order to grow its trunk and to get stronger and resilient. And so, the wraps should only be used for temporary protection.
So she should she take them off now?
Take it off.
Yeah. That's what I was thinking.
Come off.
Take them off,
yeah.
Ellen. Thank you for calling.
Take it off.
Gary in Madison, your turn.
Yes, I was. I'm wondering about my yard, and there's areas in my yard that, you know, the grass is not growing well, and there's big bare spots, and et cetera, et cetera. And we were thinking about, is it a good idea to till, you know, like an area, even though you might be tilling up some of the grass that's already on the ground, mm-hmm. and then adding more soil and then seeding.
That is the way that lawns used to be established. I don't know that, depending on how large the size of your bare spots are, I don't know if that's the best way.
Maybe 10 by...
Oh, that's pretty big. You probably don't need to till per se, but you could go in there and rough up the soil with a hard rake, and then add like a half-inch layer of compost. It doesn't have to be topsoil. Sometimes with topsoil you get lots of weed seeds and other things. But if you just rough up the soil surface and then do your seeding, as we discussed earlier, it's a little bit late in the season for seeding, but in some situations it's better to seed late than not at all, because you just don't know what the weather's going to bring in the next 3 weeks. If we have the next 3 weeks of fairly decent weather where we're, you know, fairly warm and not freezing, you could get decent seed germination. But roughing up that soil is really important. Covering the seed with either the cellulose or straw or a light layer of compost, something to get good seed-soil contact. And then the most important thing is making sure the whole area stays moist. Every day, it needs to be watered lightly every day for 2 to 3 weeks until you get really good seed germination.
Yep, there you go. Tracy, who is a former master gardener of yours, Patty, emailed. She just moved away from her beloved weeping willow tree in Racine. She took a few cuttings with the intention of trying to do a weeping willow bonsai. The cuttings have been in a bucket of water for the last 3 weeks and are rooting beautifully. Do you any advice for planting to give it the best chance of surviving, and any tips for keeping it alive inside? She realizes bonsais is a challenging sport, so she's prepared for failure, but would love to see if she can make it go.
I know this Tracy, and I know she's up for a challenge, and she can do this. Bonsai is kind of a special thing. There are a lot of techniques involved, and so you have to do your research, Tracy, and really work it out. But I know you can do it. When you're working with a bonsai tree that is not an interior tree, so a lot of times people will start with something like ficus, like weeping fig, in you know, that's a house plant, because yeah. You can keep it inside year round. The thing to remember about the willow is that it is an outdoor tree. So that means you need to pot it up and get those roots growing in a soil mixture, but not in a huge pot because you're going to be bonsaiing it. And then you need to find a place outdoors where you can sink that pot in the ground so that it has the benefit of being outdoors but in the ground and protected, the root system protected from the extreme temperatures. And then you treat it like you would any other shrub that you planted. You mulch around it, and then you come back in the spring, and then you can pull it back out and start practicing your bonsai skills on it. Willows are really fun to work with because they have those what's called preformed root initials. So if you ever want to root a willow, it's super easy because they have everything ready to go. So they're really fun to play with because they're so easy to root. So I'm sure you have lots of cuttings, and you're able to plant out a bunch of them, so you have many to practice on next spring. But it really needs to go outside because it's an outdoor plant that needs to have the winter weather over this next cold season.
Maybe time for another quick question. DJ and Spooner wonders what time of year is optimal for moving iris bulbs to a different spot in the yard.
Oh, iris, you know, a lot of times people do that even in late summer, because as soon as the flowers fade and they start to decline, you really can go in there and cut those leaves down to eliminate the iris borer infestations. So anytime from August through September, and I guess even now you could still do it now, you could lift those rhizomes and separate them. It's important to inspect those rhizomes and make sure they don't have any little wormholes in them from the iris borer, and make sure you're only replanting clean ones. But you can still do that now, absolutely. It's not too late.
It's not too late, but it is getting too late for you and for me, Patty.
Oh, that's so sad, Larry. I'm so sad to say goodbye.
Well, will you come back and be with us again?
Absolutely. I'm retired. Well, I can do what I want, Larry. Just invite me.
All right. Patty, thank you so much. By the way, quickly, how's your lemon and your lime trees going?
Well, I moved my lime inside, but I left my lemons out, and they look really good. But I don't have a lot of fruit production this year, so I'm going to have to be doing some inside pollination with my little Q-tip and my little fake bee noises, my buzzing noises, to pollinate some flowers this fall when they bloom again.
Patty, we'll talk soon. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Larry. Have a great weekend.
You too. Patty Nagai, retired UW Extension horticulture educator, our guest. Always great to have her with us, and she will be back. She does a great job, doesn't she? Next week on Garden Talk, another person who does a great job, Brian Huddleston, back to talk about plant diseases. So I hope you can join us for that at 11 o'clock on Friday, at 6 o'clock on Saturday morning, or online anytime. And join us Monday when we take a look at today's 4-H organizational business. Check in with Inga Wisher as well from Around the Farm Table. That's Monday starting at 11 on the Ideas Network. In the meantime, boy, there's lots more good things in store for us here on the Ideas Network, so you stay with us. I'm Larry Mehler.